What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping
you? Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. And we are delighted to have you with us. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters, those of you who are not Catholic, but you've got a question about the Catholic faith that you would just love to have answered. Why does the Church teach this and they don't teach this over here? Well, we can answer questions of any sort regarding the Catholic faith. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. My personal recommendation, since it is a Friday and people do want to call in and get those questions answered, call early. Don't wait around till the last 10 minutes of the show. We may not be able to get you on. 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, and then when you get that, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may, for some folks, apply. And of course, you can always send us an email. We'll get to one of those in a second. ctc@ewtn.com is the address. ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Vanessa Sanchez on the phones, Rich Jesse handling social media for us. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming there, both those platforms live right now. Just put your comment in the, put your question in the comments box. That's what I'm trying to say. Put your question in the comments box. Rich will see it. He'll shoot it to us here in the studio, and hopefully we can answer it on today's program. Three lines available right now, 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm great. How are you, sir?
Doing decent, thank you.
So weekend plans for Dr. Anders and the family?
Well, you know, as usual, it's just going to be more and more domestics.
The punch list.
Yep.
As they say.
And a little bit of Catholic life coaching, too. I got some appointments.
All right. Very good. So we're going to lead off with this question. Interesting, from Debbie. How do I die to myself? What does that mean?
Yeah, thank you. So here's what it does not mean. It doesn't mean hurting yourself.
Okay.
It doesn't mean doing things that are contrary to your own flourishing or well-being, right? There's a saying in Catholic theology that grace does not destroy nature, meaning that our redemption in Christ doesn't frustrate our humanity, it fulfills it.
Okay.
It leads to
its
flourishing. And so, you know, you as we become holy in Jesus, it's going to perfect, not deform our personalities. So St. Thomas says in one place that we love God by loving the perfection of our own nature. That's how you do it, right?
Yeah.
And let me kind of give you a concrete of how that might play out. Let's say that you are a disaffected spouse.
Okay.
You have a spouse that you feel like ignores your needs, doesn't spend time with you, doesn't show you affection, maybe spends too much time, you know, flipping through social media and talking to his or her friends, either the golf course or the hair salon or whatever it might be, and you feel like you're getting leftovers, okay? And you're sad about that, which is a reasonable response, okay? But then you have a choice to make. And the choice is, you know, let's say your inclination is indignation, moral indignation, and to nurse a grudge. And so you don't tell anybody about it, but you start walking around ruminating,
grumble,
and I'm getting the short end of the stick here, and this person's like not doing what I need, and I'm not and then that grudge becomes the seed of a justification for something darker, and you turn to some outlet, some habit, some behavior. It could be merely mental, might be something else. You know, I deserve this. I deserve that extra glass of wine, or I deserve that TV show that I ought not to watch, or, you know, I deserve that clandestine relationship because I'm not getting my needs met, grr, right? That's not dying to yourself. That is nurturing the darkest parts of your personality, right? Here's what dying to self would look like. I'm not going to be that guy. I'm not going to be that girl. Maybe I am getting the short end of the stick. Maybe my spouse isn't perfect. But I'm aiming at a life where when I'm eulogized, people will speak of me like as an admirable person with virtues that they admire, who bore up with magnanimity under adverse circumstances, and I imitate the lives of the saints. And so, you know what? I'm going to start asking myself the question, what's going on in the life of my spouse? Where are they hurting? Why might they be seeking to meet their emotional needs in this immature way, right? Am I really so much better than they are, right? How can I be more present to them? What could I do to make them desire me more, right? Maybe I'm nitpicky. Maybe my indignation and my constant whining and demand for needs is driving them away. Maybe they're in pain and I don't know about it because I haven't bothered to find out. And I start looking to that person's needs when maybe I feel like they don't deserve it. But I'm going to do it because it's the Christian loving moral thing to do, right? Well, here's the irony. You start acting that way, and guess what? More often than not, that spouse is going to come around and start paying you more attention. You're going to find that your relationship is enhanced. Your life is going to flourish. Things are going to go better for you, and you're going to be happier. See what I mean? Grace actually enhances and causes nature to flourish, right?
Yes.
But it begins with death to that sinful inclination to nurture that indignation and that selfishness and that pride.
Debbie, we hope that's helpful for you. Thanks so much for your email. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, the address is this, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. We try to answer at least one, maybe two or three emails on each of our live programs, and then every so often we will put together a great mailbag program where we answer a whole bunch of questions that we've received over the past couple of weeks. Again, the email address, ctc@ewtn.com. But the main focus today, of course, is those live phone calls from you. People like Doug in Aloha, Oregon, Joanne in Reading, Massachusetts, Adolfo in Mulberry, Florida, David in Arizona. Looks like two lines open right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews on this Friday afternoon. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. We do have two lines open, 833-288-3986. Here's something beautiful for you from EWTN's religious catalog, and that is the framed print of St. Joseph, Guardian of Sons. You know, the Nativity of St. John the Baptist is coming up on next Tuesday, and there's a beautiful picture that depicts a young John the Baptist holding a cross with the Agnus Dei proclamation as he kneels to pay homage to Jesus, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. In this print, Jesus is seated on St. Joseph's lap as if upon a throne, a stalk of lilies as his scepter, while petting a lamb by his side. This was originally painted by 19th century Swiss artist Melchior Paul de Schwanden. I think I got that right. This unique fine art print is framed in a decorative gold wooden frame. It comes ready to hang. It's about 14 inches wide by 18 inches high. It sounds beautiful. You can see it by going to EWTNRC.com. Do check it out. It is, again, EWTNRC.com. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Doug in Aloha, Oregon, listening on the great Modern Day Radio. Happy Friday, Doug. What's on your mind today, sir?
Happy Friday to you, Tom, and Dr. Andrews. Thank you for this wonderful ministry. Yesterday, you received an email from a man saying that the priest started the prayers that the people were supposed to say.
Yeah.
And Dr. Anders responded saying that the celebrant has his own text to say and the congregation has their text to say. And when I, for most of my Catholic life, I've been using the terms celebrant and congregation. But 25 years ago, an executive at a Catholic publisher and also a couple priests corrected me, saying that we have now changed it to presider and assembly, because celebrant means that he's the only celebrant, and they said that all the priest and the people are all celebrating the Mass. And so I was wondering if Dr. Anders could clarify the liturgical terminology, presider and assembly versus celebrant and congregation.
Thanks. I appreciate the question. So first of all, with respect to the comment about yesterday's show, I may have misunderstood that call, because I thought the priest was inviting the congregation to complete parts of his prayers. And to my mind,
that's what I got.
That's a bigger problem than the priest saying part of the congregation's prayers, because there are parts of the Mass that by law and by definition could only be validly performed by a priest. Right.
Yep.
And so to invite the laity to participate in those, like, you know, to say the words of consecration, for example, would be a real gross liturgical abuse. That's the question I thought I was answering yesterday.
Yes.
And if the priest said a little bit of the laity's part, it's not following the rubrics, but I think it would be a less egregious fault.
Okay.
I am not familiar with this change in terminology. And when I think about the theology of the Mass, the way the church conceptualizes it is that the entire church offers the Immaculate Victim in the consecrated species, but it is only the ordained priest that effects the offering, right? So he is the one that consecrates the elements and causes the body and blood of Christ to be made present on the altar. Without him, there is no sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
But then it becomes true that the entire church makes the offering. I don't see why the fact that the church participates in the act of offering renders the term celebrant inappropriate, right? I'm not familiar with this distinction, and I can't comment any further.
Is that helpful for you, Doug?
Yes, thank you very much.
Appreciate your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. V is watching us on YouTube today. V says, if you've been baptized as Christian as a baby, but haven't been to the church for a while, are you still Catholic?
Yes. Yeah. Whoever has been baptized has clothed himself with Christ. That's what St. Paul says in his letter to the Galatians.
All right, there you go, V. Glad we could answer that. Adolfo, listening to us in Mulberry, Florida, on the EWTN app. Hello, Adolfo. What's on your mind today?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Oh, okay. My phone or something's acting up, because I heard you answering the other call, then it all of a sudden, beep, and I didn't finish. But anyway, my question is, I remember as a child, of course, I'm 62 now, and every time we started Mass, everybody stood up when the priest, the father, come in to celebrate the Mass. But then when he gets up to the altar, everybody remains standing until he sits down. Now, a lot of people just start sitting down without respecting him first, to sit down first, or am I incorrect of saying that?
I think you're not incorrect, and this is not a change in the rubrics of the Mass. I think it's just a change in the strictness of their application. People can get sloppy.
Yeah, happens. Adolfo, thanks so much for your call today. Joanne is a first-time caller from Reading, Massachusetts, listening on Sirius XM, channel 130. Very glad. I should mention this more often. We're very grateful that Sirius XM carries us and has been carrying us on their wonderful satellite radio platform for now 25 years.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely amazing. So a big tip of the hat there to Sirius XM. Glad to be on channel 130. Joanne, what's on your mind today? Joanne, are you there?
Yes. Oh, yes. Hi. My question has to do with my husband, who... he's been married to me for 45 years. I'm Catholic. He was baptized Lutheran, confirmed Lutheran. He began, you know, his life with me. We were married in the Catholic Church, raised our children in the Catholic faith, and he has continued to go to Mass weekly. However, he has not converted. He doesn't see the need, as he says. But my question has to do with a Christian Mass at a funeral. Is it allowed
in
the Catholic Church?
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. So the Church does permit a Catholic funeral to be performed for a non-Catholic baptized person if a few conditions are met. First of all, if the person does not object to having a Catholic funeral, and if the a minister of his own church is not available, right, then it can be done. Now, I think, you know, it would be up to the judgment of the priest and the bishop to determine how do you evaluate the criteria: is a minister of his own church not available? I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is it's not hard to come up with a Lutheran minister, right?
I mean, but if he hasn't been going to a Lutheran church.
Exactly. But if he hasn't, I mean, even though he hasn't been going in 40 years, I mean, you could always pay somebody and they'll come do anything for you, right? I mean, you could find one. But I imagine, and this is just my guess, I imagine that the Catholic bishop would say, you know, we're not talking about a hired gun here. You know, we're talking about his pastor, and he doesn't have a pastor who's a Lutheran because he hasn't been in Lutheran church. So he'd probably fit the criterion.
Right, right.
So I mean, obviously, you defer to the judgment of the bishop. That's the third criteria: is the bishop has to give permission. But I suspect there's, you know, the probability here is yes, they would allow a Catholic funeral for your husband.
Joanne, thanks so much for your call. I'm glad you're listening to us in Reading, Massachusetts. Call to Communion on this Friday afternoon here on EWTN. Two lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Let's go to Cleveland now. Talk with Dawn, listening on AM 1260, The Rock. Hey there, Dawn, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hello. My question is, I try to shorten it up. The Roman Catholic Church says you're allowed to marry the deceased, and which I did in 2019. Do I need to end this, and how?
Can you restate
Excuse me, can you restate
that question, Dawn?
Okay. The Roman Catholic says you're allowed to marry a deceased person.
No.
That's
you
not
can't,
correct.
You can't marry a dead person. No.
Oh. Okay. I guess that.
But I'm wondering if there's a confusion here. So why don't you tell me what happened, like, not in the abstract, but the particular of your situation, and we can...
Well, first, I was married to a man, and I know I wasn't allowed to remarry unless I got an annulment.
So, were you married outside the Catholic Church?
Yes, it was outside. It wasn't with a priest, but...
Okay, now, is that man that you were first man that you were married to, is he still alive?
No.
All right. Have you married anybody else since then?
No.
The Catholic Church would regard you as a single woman, right? Because the first man you were with has deceased, and you haven't taken on any other man, and so you're a single woman, so you could marry anyone validly in the Catholic Church, and you would not need an annulment, because there's no marriage for you to be annulled from. There's no man in the picture, right? So you can freely marry in the Catholic Church.
Okay. Dawn, thanks so much for your call from Cleveland. Let's stay in Ohio and go to Marysville, talking with Marie, listening to us on Sirius XM Channel 130. Marie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, did you say Maury?
Marie or Maury?
Maury, yes.
Sure.
First, I want to thank you for fulfilling a lot of spiritual questions for me.
Thank you.
My sister's Catholic. I am Episcopalian, and I like to go to church with her. But the one thing that makes me sad and bothers me is that during communion, the offering of Jesus's body and blood is given only to Catholics instead of given to all children of our Father. Why is that?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. There's several reasons for it, okay? And let me lay them out for you. So one is that St. Paul, in his first letter to the Corinthians, is extremely explicit that our act of communion signals our solidarity with one another in one faith. And he's again, very explicit about what that means. He says in the epistle that it is necessary for us to agree on everything, that is a condition of our unity. And so when a Catholic goes to communion in the Catholic Church, among other things, he is pledging his solidarity with Catholic belief and practice, and it's our belief that this is what Christ taught us. I mean, he didn't teach us generic Christianity. He taught us the Catholic faith that's been handed down for 2,000 years, and other churches don't agree with the Catholic faith. And so, you know, why would I invite you, and no disrespect to you at all, I mean, presuming that you don't actually believe the Catholic faith, why would I invite you to perjure yourself? Because what Catholics mean by communion is, among other things, a pledge of loyalty to the teaching of the Catholic Church. Well, by definition, if someone's not Catholic, they're not affirming the teaching of the Catholic Church. Why would they engage in a rite that signifies agreement with Catholic teaching, when in fact they don't agree with Catholic teaching? It'd be asking them to engage in a performative contradiction, to perjure themselves, to bear false witness against themselves. And that wouldn't be good for any of us, wouldn't be good for the person involved. Why would we invite them to do that?
Right? As you have said in the past, it'd be like saluting the flag of a foreign country.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. So another reason is that Catholics themselves are not permitted to go to communion. I mean, I'm Catholic, and I can't go to communion if I have done some gravely wrong thing and have yet to be absolved for that sin by the Church. The Church has to kind of authorize me to go to communion. And St. Paul, again, tells us in the same letter that if I go to communion and I'm not properly disposed, meaning I haven't received absolution for my sins, then I'm not doing myself any good. I'm actually doing myself grave spiritual harm. That's exactly what the apostle says. I challenge you to go read the letter. And the way that a person is sort of made right after a grave sin like that is submitting himself to the Church's judgment, to the jurisdiction of the Catholic Church in the form of the confessional, and then I know I'm safe to go, right? Well, again, non-Catholics don't submit themselves to the Church's jurisdiction. They're not going to confession to a Catholic priest. And so the Church has no power to judge. I mean, we don't judge those outside. It's no judgment against Episcopalians. We're not saying Episcopalians are bad people. We're saying we don't know what kind of people they are. Could be good people, could be bad people. Like, we only judge Catholics. We're non-judgmental with regard to others. Because we can judge the souls of Catholics, we can admit or exclude from communion. Because we refuse to pass judgment on those outside the Church, we have to say, well, you know, we have no way to evaluate. Like, you're not submitting yourself for evaluation here. You're not bringing this to the tribunal of the Church in the form of the confessional. So it wouldn't be safe to admit you to communion. If we admit you to communion, then you might do yourself grave spiritual harm, even as I would incur grave spiritual harm if I went to communion without being properly disposed. So it's really a work of mercy towards the non-Catholic to say, hey, bud, don't put yourself in potential spiritual danger here by receiving communion when you're not properly disposed, which we refuse to say on your behalf because you're not Catholic, okay? Third, you know, you mentioned the offering of Christ's body and blood to the faithful, and there's a terminological change there that's very different from the way the Catholic Church conceptualizes what's going on. In Catholic theology, the body and blood of Christ are actually offered to God the Father.
Mm.
They're not offered to the laity. They're offered to God the Father because we regard the Mass as a sacrifice. That has implications for our mode of reception, and I'll get to that after the break.
All right, stick with us there. I believe it's Maureen in Marysville, Ohio. We also can take your phone call at 833-288-EWTN for Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. It's Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, or perhaps you'd like to explain what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic, 833-288-EWTN. 888-3986. Before the break, we were talking with, I believe it was Maureen in Ohio, who was questioning, as you know, because she is not a Catholic, why can she not receive communion in a Catholic church?
Yeah, so I was going down a list of reasons. And the first one, of course, is that communion in the Catholic Church is a pledge of loyalty to the Catholic Church and to its doctrines.
Sure.
And so it would be strange to invite someone to, you know, invite them to, hey, come here and pledge your loyalty to Catholicism and all its teaching, when they manifestly do not intend to do any such thing, right? Secondly, communion in the Catholic Church is a very dangerous thing for Catholics to do if they're not properly disposed, and it is the confessional that allows us to be properly disposed mm-hmm. if we are conscious of grave sin. St. Paul says, judge those inside the church, don't judge those outside the church. Those who are outside the Catholic Church, we refuse to pass judgment on, and so because the church has no jurisdiction over them, has no capacity to assess their rightness to receive communion, right? I mean, I can't assess if you're in mortal sin or not, if you're not subject to the church's jurisdiction. And so as a matter of safety, you know, you don't administer communion to someone to whom it might potentially do harm, right? Third, I said, Maureen had used the language of offering the body and blood of Christ to the faithful. And I said, that's not the way Catholics think of it at all. The Catholic doctrine of the Mass is that the body and blood of Christ are offered to God the Father. And as a sacrifice offered to God, you know, the Old Testament sacrifices required a ritual purity. The sacrifices of the New Covenant require an interior purity, a purity of heart, without which no one will see God. Hence, again, the emphasis on proper preparation and proper disposition. And if there's one thing that's very clear about the difference between historic Anglicanism and Episcopalianism on the one hand and the Catholic Church on the other, it's that the Episcopal Church, like other mainstream Protestant churches, has always rejected the doctrine that the Mass is a sacrifice. I'm actually staring at the 39 articles right now, and I'm looking at Article 31, and it says, wherefore the sacrifice of the Mass, in which it was commonly said that the priest did offer Christ for the quick and the dead to have remission of pain or guilt, were blasphemous fables and dangerous deceits. Right.
Wow.
So the official doctrine of the Episcopal Church is that the holy sacrifice of the Mass of the Catholics is a blasphemous fable and a dangerous deceit, right? Now, for an Episcopalian who wishes to receive communion in the Catholic Church, there can only be one of two reasons for that given this Episcopal doctrine. One is that they reject the doctrine of the Episcopal Church, or they are ignorant of the teaching of the Catholic Church.
Mm.
As no other possibility.
Right,
like
right.
If you're a sincere Episcopalian who knows your faith, then you understand that you are to understand the Catholic Mass as a blasphemous fable. Well, either you reject the teaching of the Episcopal Church or you're ignorant of the teaching of the Catholic Church, right?
Yeah,
can't
yeah.
have it both ways.
Right, right.
If you're ignorant of the teaching of the Catholic Church, then we want to help you understand what it is that we're asking you to partake in, right? And again, come back to St. Paul's admonition, I insist that you agree on everything, all right? And then finally, one last consideration, and that is, I understand that there are non-Catholic Christians who take great offense at the fact that Catholics will not admit them to Holy Communion. Let me tell you something. Cranmer would not have taken offense.
Who is Cranmer?
Cranmer was the theologian that formulated the 39 articles and was sort of the theological bedrock of Anglicanism.
Okay.
John
right.
Calvin would not have taken offense. Martin Luther would not have taken offense. They would have taken it as a matter of pride to have been excluded from the Catholic Mass because they hated the Catholic Mass.
Mm.
I mean, they were explicit in holding the Catholic Mass to be a blasphemy. And Luther said that the Catholic Mass was the worst blasphemy and sacrilege that the Catholic Church had ever committed, and was one of his chief reasons for rejecting Catholicism. He thought
wow.
the Mass was a horrible, horrible, horrible thing, and to have been excluded from it would have been his pride and joy, right? Obviously, most Protestants who want to take communion in the Catholic Church do not understand it that way. Instead, they bring a completely different theology to bear. What is that theology? Since the 18th century, Protestantism has largely embraced the ideology of denominationalism. Let me explain what I mean by that. There have always been different denominations, always been different groups of Christians sort of in competition with one another. Most of human history, most of Christian history, each individual denomination has regarded itself as the one true church. Like, well, we're the guys who got it right and everybody else is wrong, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But in the 18th century, that began to shift within Protestantism, and a new ideology emerged, which was that the diversity of denominations were like so many flavors of ice cream. And so, you know, the real church was an invisible reality that resided in the hearts of the faithful who agreed in their interior experience of Christ or their conversion or their love of Jesus. And things like differences over the Pope or baptism or, you know, these other doctrines were immaterial. And so the important thing is to have that personal relationship with Jesus and affirm our commonality of brothers in the Lord, recognizing these other things don't matter. All right. And so with that attitude, like if I'm a Baptist and I can receive communion in a Presbyterian church, or I'm a Lutheran and I receive communion in an Episcopal church, it seems a way symbolically of gesturing to that idea, hey, we're all brothers in the Lord after all, and these differences don't really matter. And I think it comes from a position of goodwill, right, sincerity, when a Protestant says, I'd like to receive communion in the Catholic Church. I mean, he sees this as an act of magnanimity on his part. Like, I'm conceding that Catholics are Christians too. Like, we all worship the same Jesus. Can't we just get on board and worship the same Jesus? And he sees that as a positive gesture on his part. And I recognize that. And I appreciate that. And I'm not upset about that. Like, I know where that's coming from. But what I'm at pains to establish is that Catholic Church does not adhere to the doctrine of denominationalism, right? And to ask the Catholic Church to accept the communion of Protestants is to ask the Catholic Church to reduce itself to the status of one more Christian denomination, asking us to accept that there are no substantive differences. We all worship the same Lord. We're all friends of Jesus, and all these other things don't matter, when manifestly they do matter. Manifestly they do matter, right? It matters to Catholics that Christ established the church with a particular constitution, that we have a pope and that we have bishops with apostolic succession and sacraments from those succession, that we have a determinate body of teaching to which we hold, a determinate moral theology that we seek to live by, right? These things are not matters of indifference. They are essential to Christian identity. And the insistence that we level those differences in the interests of a kind of sentimental ecumenism is to ask Catholics to stop being Catholic.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Now, how do we feel about Episcopalians? We love Episcopalians. We are so happy to worship with them. We are happy to pray with them. We are happy for Episcopalians to remain Episcopalian and to be good Episcopalians. We're not trying to insist that you become Catholic. And we don't look badly on you. We don't look down on you for not being Catholic.
No,
we love you, and we say, well, have at it, man. You know, like, be all you can be. You know, be the best Episcopalian you can be. Follow the grace of God in your own tradition. Come to Jesus, and we will celebrate, right, together in heaven. Hopefully, that's what we're all looking forward to, right? So we're not, and again, this doesn't come from a place of passing judgment on the soul of the individual Episcopalian. We manifestly don't do that, right?
Right.
But what we can't do, ultimately, is surrender our own identity as Catholics, right, in the service of a sincere but misplaced ecumenism.
Maureen, thanks so much for your call today from Ohio, I believe it was, called to communion here on EWTN, and we are glad that you are with us as well. Let's go now to, before we go to another call, I want to give a shout-out to a couple of friends of ours, David, and that would be our very own Father Pascal Mary and Father John Paul Mary, who were ordained on this day in 2013.
How about that?
12 years. Fantastic. So congratulations, guys. God bless you. Now we're going to go to the phones and talk with Kathleen, a first-time caller from New York, listening on the EWTN app. Hello, Kathleen. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Dr. Anders. I wanted to ask, is it okay for a former Presbyterian minister who newly became Catholic to continue to celebrate non-Catholic funerals?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, I'm not an expert in canon law, and this is a very canon law-y kind of question,
yeah,
right? You know, I've often gotten the question about whether a Catholic could celebrate a non-Catholic wedding, and I do think there are contexts in which that would be permitted. Like, say, for example, if you were a Catholic justice of the peace and you were presiding over a secular ceremony for a civil wedding in what would otherwise be a valid natural marriage, right? I don't see that would be problematic. And you know, I could imagine scenarios that seem to me unproblematic here, where someone's not going to be buried in the Catholic Church, but some kind of rites to remember and venerate them seem appropriate, and there's only a Catholic available to do that. I mean, I think there'd be kind of an appropriate way to do that. Not obviously with the caveat that I defer to what the canon says, and I don't know
sure.
what the canon say. Right?
Sure.
But I could also see situations in which that would be problematic. So, for example, you mentioned Presbyterian. I mean, the Presbyterian is a sort of quasi-liturgical tradition. There are rites of prayer and sacraments, ordinances in the Presbyterian Church that follow a specific formula. And I know I was married in a Presbyterian ceremony, and it was just read from the book, man. It was like following the rubrics of a Catholic Mass. It was a pretty prescribed set of prayers, right?
Oh, yeah.
And the Presbyterian Church's belief about the dead is very different from Catholic belief. And so if I am a Catholic, I don't want to officiate over a rite that affirms a non-Catholic doctrine, right? I don't want to do that, right? So while I think it might be theoretically possible, I would attend very carefully to what I was saying, what I was being asked to do, to make sure that I wasn't affirming anything that the Catholic Church actually rejects.
Kathleen, thanks so much for your phone call. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Coming up tomorrow on the Bear Wozniak Adventure. It's going to be a great show. The co-host of the Sunrise Morning Show, Matt Swaim, sits down in the Man Cave for a lively discussion on Catholicism with Bear. Should be a great one. 6 p.m. Eastern tomorrow, right here and only here on EWTN Radio. Let's go now to Russ in Nashville, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hello, Russ. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, happy Friday.
And you.
Dr. Anders, what's the role and method for giving to the poor and to the church? I don't think Catholics hold to the tithe. So what's the role, and how do you do it, and how do you know you're doing it right?
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate the question. So Catholics do not hold to the tithe. There is no canonical obligation to tithe for Catholics. There is a canonical obligation to contribute to the material needs of the church, and there's no specific percentage that is indicated, just that Catholics are to do this. When it comes to caring for the poor, this is a spiritual mandate from Christ himself, and in fact, it's listed as one of the criteria by which we will be admitted or excluded to heaven. I mean, Christ says, if you don't feed the hungry and clothe the naked and give drink to the thirsty and shelter the homeless and visit the sick and the imprisoned, then away from me, I never knew you, right? I mean, he's pretty strict about that. And again, there's no hard and fast rule on you have to do it in this particular way. And if you read the lives of the saints, you find that there are as many ways of caring for the poor as there are human personalities,
yeah.
Right? So we don't all have to be Mother Teresa. But some of us can be Mother Teresa. Back in my brief abortive business career, I was trying to kick around for a model for Catholic businessmen, and I stumbled upon a medieval saint named Saint Homobonus. Saint,
really?
Saint Good Guy, right? and he was a businessman who owned like a medieval shoe factory, and he, you know, acquired a lot of wealth through commerce, and he distributed that money to the poor to, you know, meet their basic needs. And he was different from Mother Teresa because he had a workshop making shoes, you know?
Yeah.
And so it really is, I mean, it's kind of like asking, does the church prescribe the precise way that you're supposed to love your wife or celebrate Valentine's Day? Well, of course not.
No.
Just love your wife, you know,
yeah.
Love the poor, take care of them. And some people are going to do that with, you know, profligately, where they, you know, literally give their entire life and every ounce of their own material welfare to the care of the poor, and others are going to do it in a more kind of, formulaic, accounting appropriate way that meets the needs of their own family. So your own vocation in life, your own marital state, your own material needs and so forth all are going to play into how you answer that question. But that there is an obligation to the care for the poor is a non-negotiable, all right? The Catholic Church makes it easy for you in some respects, because most Catholic dioceses will have ministries of care for the poor. And so, you know, an indirect way of doing this is to do things like, you know, contribute to the Catholic Charities or Catholic Social Services campaign in your own diocese, or, you know, kick around for those ministries in your local community that care for the poor in some way that speaks to you. Could be, one that I'm fond of is to contribute monies for scholarships for poor children to attend Catholic schools.
Oh yeah,
you know, that's beautiful. Something that is that can be done, you know, almost everywhere. You know, you can give directly to you know, food and you know, power bill relief through things like in our diocese we have something called the Centers of Concern, which are these, you know, drop-in centers where people can go to have their basic needs met.
Uh-huh.
Most dioceses have a Department of Catholic Family Services mm-hmm. that provides counseling and adoption services and things like that. I mean, there are just like 1,000 different ways you can give to Catholic relief services for, you know, helping in natural disasters and things like that overseas. I mean, there's just there's so many ministries that do this, it's impossible to just single out one.
Russ, thanks so much for your call today. Juan is watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Juan poses a follow-up question to something we were talking about earlier. So the question is from Juan. He says, so then Catholics or one of the Orthodox churches should not be considered a denomination,
correct?
No,
I didn't say that. So it depends on how you use the word, right? It is a fact of history that Christians have grouped themselves into competing tribes, right?
Sure.
You know, the term denomination to describe those is kind of a modern invention, right?
Yeah.
And if the only thing you mean is, you know, by denomination, I mean, you know, one of these competing Christian groups, well, I mean, you could use that terminology, I suppose, right? The problem comes in with the ideology of denominationalism, which is a modern Protestant idea that the church consists in sort of the sum total of all its denominations. And that is not a Catholic idea at all. I mean, the Bible doesn't talk about denominations as such.
Catholic
history doesn't. I mean, Scripture talks about the church founded by Christ that has a historic continuity through time. And the Catholic Church understands itself to be that thing. And so what others would call a denomination, the Catholics would consider it one way or another schismatic. I mean, these are groups that have broken off from Catholic unity.
Yeah.
You know, denomination is a less polemical term, but it also risks sort of reducing Catholicism to something less than what it claims to be.
Appreciate that. And Juan, thanks for watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Here is Jason now in Kentucky listening on the Great Eucharist Radio. Hello, Jason. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hey, how you doing? I have a quick question. Now, just a little bit of background on me. I'm a Protestant who's married to a Catholic, and I'm working on the conversion process. But I ran across an article which is totally unrelated to that. Maybe a little over a year ago, it was a digital article, but it was from a legitimate newspaper or magazine. I can't remember which one. And I know that I read, and I'd like Dr. Andrews' opinion on it, whether he knows about it or not. And I'm pretty sure it's not true, but I'd love to know that whichever dicastery of the Catholic Church who is responsible for making saints is looking at a case for John Ronald Reuel Tolkien to be beatified. Is that true? Yes, no, maybe, or not true at all?
For all that I know, and I don't know nearly everything, I am unaware of there being an official cause before the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints for the beatification of J.R. Tolkien. What I do know is that there have been a lot of internet articles making the case for such a cause. So if you type in, you know, beatification of J.R. Tolkien, you'll in your search engine, you're going to get hits on lots of people who say, here's why Tolkien should be a saint. That's very different from his local diocese actually initiating the cause and taking it to the See of Rome and saying, let's get this thing started, right? And I'm not aware that that has happened.
Okay.
I'm not aware that that has happened.
All right. That's where we got to leave it, Jason. Thanks for checking in from Kentucky, and very glad that you're listening on the Great Eucharist Radio. Called to Communion here on EWTN. Got a question from Linda in Ramona, California, listening to the Great JP2 Radio. Linda says, if Jesus loves us so much as his children, why did the saints back in the days hurt themselves to show that they love God? If my child told me that they love me so much they would whip and hit themselves to show love, I would want them to stop.
Yeah, right. So anyone that engages in self-flagellation in order to demonstrate to God that they love him has, in my opinion, a very demented spirituality. and the church does not advocate any such thing. Nor, to the best of my knowledge, do the saints engage in such practices for that reason, right? Now, there are occasions in which an individual ought to undertake ascetical exercises, you know, exercises of self-discipline of some kind or another, fasting, prayer, and maybe even more arduous tasks, right? But it wouldn't be as a demonstration to God of their love. What it would be is an attempt to master their own passions and impulses. So, you know, St. Francis of Assisi, he would be getting a little bit frisky, and he would go jump in the snow and roll around, and that would kind of calm down his passions, you know, if you follow what I'm saying. Some of the desert fathers felt like, you know, St. Paul talks about people for whom their God is their stomach. They live to eat, you know, like I have a couple dogs in my house like that. I actually have a cat named Tessa who will never be a saint, right? And we talk about Tessa as a liar because she comes into the kitchen and hops up on the center island and meows furiously when it's time to feed her. And it's twice a day you're supposed to feed her, morning and evening. And she will let you know, buddy, if you haven't fed her. So we'll feed Tessa. Then the person who fed Tessa walks out of the room. Then somebody else walks into the room and Tessa looks at the newcomer and goes, meow? Meow.
Wow.
And like she'll get fed twice and we'll be like, wait, did you feed Tessa? Well, she said she needed it. Well, she was lying. You know, so she was not only a glutton but a liar, right? But there were some saints who would say, well, you know, I need to really work on fasting. Not because by fasting I'll prove to God that I love him, but by fasting I'll hopefully come to master the impulses of my body and get the better of them, right?
Yeah.
So the goal here is always self-mastery.
Mm-hmm.
It's not proving something to God, right? And someone who had that conception that said, well, I need to beat myself up and abuse myself in order to show God how much I love him, I think that would be a very demented spirituality. And for that reason, the church is really, really, really hesitant about recommending some of these more extreme penances. And yeah, there's some precedent in the tradition for people who have done it. And if you read some of their biographies, sometimes you're impressed. Other times you think, this guy was seriously neurotic. That doesn't look healthy. Okay.
No.
In fact, I've known counselors and psychologists who get kind of queasy in the knees when they read some saint biographies, thinking, man, this guy, I need to get him in my practice.
Yeah.
Seriously, right? Because just because you're a saint doesn't mean you can't be a little bit, you know, off base sometimes. So that's possible, and the church recognizes that and says, look, these kinds of things, you rarely are these to be undertaken, and only under the direction of a very wise spiritual director, and it would be the rare soul that would benefit from such things. They do occur. I mean, there are such cases, but again, it ought to never proceed from some sort of neurotic impulse. And you know, we know so much now about things like eating disorders and you know, like now all the kids that are sort of, you know, depressive get into this horrific custom of cutting themselves. I mean, that kind of stuff is really demented. It is the proof not of a love for God, but of self-loathing and depression and anxiety and a really sad individual. And the church wants to come by and heal such people, certainly not exacerbate those kinds of self-harming techniques at all.
Linda, thank you so much for listening to us on the great JP2 Radio there in California. I've got one more question here for you, David, and that is from Annette. If a priest breaks the seal of confession, God forbid, can a bishop laicize that priest?
If a priest breaks the seal of the confessional, he will be automatically excommunicated.
Wow.
There is a path back for his reconciliation.
Yeah.
Right? And so he could come back to being an active priest, but it'd be pretty serious business. And this is one of those sins that's reserved to the Holy See. Like, you know, just Father Bob down the street cannot absolve this sin. That's right. That gets kicked up to the Holy See for the apostolic penitentiary to deal with that. It's a very, very serious sin. Could a bishop excommunicate such a one? If he remained obstinate in his refusal to come to repentance, sure.
Okay. And one final one as we're heading out the door here from Jill. Are there animals in heaven?
Better question is, will there be animals in the resurrection? When we talk about in heaven now, we're really talking about an intermediate state between the first and second comings of Christ.
Yeah.
When the blessed dead don't have bodies, right? If you die now before the resurrection, you're just a disembodied soul. Animals don't have immortal souls. So there's literally nothing of an animal that could enjoy the beatific vision. They won't have that capacity. Will there be animals in the renewal of all things when Christ comes again and raises the dead? then I think maybe so. We don't have any promise that there will be, but I'd say that's a, I mean, there's going to be rocks. We know there'll be earth. I mean, there's going to be matter, so why not animals?
Jill, thanks so much for your call. Dr. David Andrews, have a great weekend.
I just hope there's dinosaurs.
Well, yeah. Especially, you know, like, well, I don't want, I'm just thinking of, who was it? Dino was in the Flintstones.
Oh, yeah.
Something like that. Hey, do check us out on EWTN's Call to Communion. We're back at it Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern with another edition. On behalf of our famous, fantastic team here, I'm Tom Price along with David Andrews. I think I need that weekend too. Hope that you enjoy yours. We'll see you on Monday. Have a great one and God bless.